Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho In gladness and in safety, may from bondage, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. What should sustain this recollection? This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Very good. How's the bottom one?
It's last night.
Oh, yeah, there you go, the top. That's the one behind the door, didn't answer.
Didn't answer.
Okay. So, here we go. Gautama met the Buddha Kassapa in one of his many lifetimes. Was it in this world? Yes, they say it was. The history of human civilization is the most 10,000 years. How do you know? Were you there? Is the most 10,000 years? Are you sure? Sorry?
More than that.
Could be, yes. The civilization of India is 5,000 years. Are you sure of that? I remember going off into the National Museum in Delhi, and there, obviously, just looking at the Buddha relics there, which were amazing, because they are the most authenticated relics of the Buddha. And they actually look like the bones after a cremation. Not the little small things, but you know, really solid pieces of bone, like the many cremations which I looked after when I was a young monk in Thailand. Because Wat Banana Chat was a cremation ground. So, you know, there was always cremation, maybe once a week, maybe twice a week. I remember the early days before, you know, we built a reasonable crematorium. The villagers would get the body, they could get some wood from the forest, put the body on top, and set fire to it. And sometimes, I remember once, it was in the afternoon, evening, the person who was being burned took such a long time to burn, I volunteered to look after it at night time. And so, you know, we had a big stick, because I had to keep the dogs away. Because, you know, like an arm might fall off the fire, the dogs would almost catch it. I had to warn the dogs away, just put the arm back on the fire. People think that's really gross. It's only a body. It's only just like anything else. So I was very sanguine when it came to body stuff. Even when I was in the black and white TV in my mum's and father's apartment, they used to have a program, 10 Minutes Your Body, which they showed like operations. And I really loved it, you know, just looking in there and seeing a body being taken apart. And but my parents said, we'll turn it to an... There's only had two channels, ITV, BBC in those days. Turn the other channel on. I said, no. And I always had this excuse, it's educational. And that always won the day so I could watch, and my parents left the room, they couldn't stand it. So it must be, I'm weird. But anyway, that there in the National Museum, I was looking at the exhibits of the Harappa and Mohenjo-daro civilization on the Indus. And there you saw things. I said, this is much earlier than the so-called civilization in the what's it called, in the Tigris, in the old Babylonian civilization. And as I was looking at it, this gentleman came up and he said, "Are you interested in ancient civilizations?" And I said, "Well, listen, I've got to apologize because sometimes the West is just so arrogant, as if civilization started, you know, in the, the Tigris Valley, the Babylonian civilization. And look, there's pretty strong evidence here that it was a long time before that. There was a very thriving civilization, you know, just here on the Indus River. And when they started saying the democracy started in Athens, yeah, sure. There were thriving democracies in India at that time. And they'd been there for a while. In fact, the longest continuous democratic institution in the world is the Buddhist Sangha. Even though I'm the abbot, the boss, still I don't get my way often. We have to have a meeting. We talk about it in the Sangha, and it's decided by the Sangha. They outvote me. And that's as it should be. Sometimes it's frustrating, but I'd rather have that than have a dictatorship. And that's how it's always survived. If it was a dictatorship, you wouldn't be ordained. They'd have stopped me. But because it was a democracy, we can actually decide here, devolved democracy, we could do it. So anyway, so sometimes I always question these things. And when I said this to this gentleman, he said, "Come and have a cup of tea in my office," because he was the head of the National Museum, and that was his thing to do this, and said, "At last, someone I can talk sense to." So he gave me a very delicious cup of tea. We have a nice little discussion about ancient civilizations. And the Buddha's life was in 500 BC, when urban civilization and powerful agrarian kingdoms arose in the Ganges plain, or had they already arisen? If the tales of the Buddha's past lives occurred in our world, it may not fit historical logic. Historical logic is almost like Western logic. Has there been previous civilizations a long time ago? And I forget the numbers, but I think even the indigenous civilization, 50,000 years here in Australia, 60,000, yeah. 60,000. So, and there's all types of different civilizations. One of the things with Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa in the Indus Valley, that these civilizations, now the remains of them, they were urban structures. They had roads, they had a grid pattern, and they had aqueducts to get water in and sewage out. So, I mean, this, you know, was usually an advance towards the later part of their civilization. It wasn't just like huts arranged here and there. This was an organized urban civilization a long time ago. Anyway, so it could have happened. If it's the indigenous civilization here in Australia was 60,000 years, who knows? 10,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago. Yeah, I remember seeing that one, yeah. 17, yeah. Yeah, it's up there. The Harappan civilization. Yeah. So, who knows? Sometimes much older than we think. Just like me, much older than you think. I'm an ancient. Yeah. Yeah. Well, how developed was it? Because sometimes there is an arrogance there, and it's amongst the white people, Westerners. I have to say that. And I can say that because We always think civilization started in Babylon, the dawn of civilization, and then went to the Middle East, and then sort of to Europe. Philosophy started in Greece. Even Pythagoras, he was a philosopher as well as a mathematician, Pythagoras' theorem, but he also is quoted as saying he got all of his philosophy and ideas from India. Oh, that's really interesting, and nobody really wants to work out exactly what it means. Because, just white people. Western civilization. We started all of the development of the world. But, you know, sometimes you see, is that true? Winners are the ones who write the history. But anyway, now it's, you know, people get all this evidence out, 17,000 Hara for civilization. There we go. That's a long time ago. Sorry?
Yeah.
Yeah.
75,000
years. And it keeps on. Even the other interesting thing, okay, this is my theory, but there's some in the movement of tectonic plates that Australia and India were the one and the same continent.
10,000.
Gondwana land. 10,000. Excellent. Because if you actually look at Australia and you look at India, it actually, that West Australia actually fits in to there. And you can imagine just how it drifted apart. And so sometimes you wonder why it is that we had such a successful monastery here in Western Australia and in Dharamsala. What's so special about this? Why didn't this happen in Sydney or Melbourne or Queensland or United States? Why is it such a great place here to meditate? And actually the rocks which we are, this monastery is built on, they are exactly the same rock formations you find in the east coast of India. So, 10,000 years ago, Gondwana. 17,000 years ago, the Harappan civilization. So, you would have been able to walk from the Harappan civilization to Jhana Grove. There would be no sea to cross. So maybe Kassapa the Buddha did walk over these hills we're now sitting on. Maybe that's one of the reasons why this is a very powerful place where we meditate today. Ooh. Thank you for that, because I like to say those things. Anyway, there's now a debate in contemporary Buddhism of what Buddha means by anatta. A contemporary debate, they've always had arguments between people who haven't penetrated the Dhamma yet. But anyway, oh my goodness me. My meditation teacher, following a famous teacher in USA, that's Tinisaro, teaches that it is a skillful means to overcome clinging, rather than whether self exists or not. In the second sermon of the Buddha, he states that if the five aggregates are of anicca, dukkha, is it fitting to regard them as I, me, or mine? However, there is a saying in the Dhammapada that sabbe dhamma anatta. Is there a contradiction? Of course, sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe dhamma anatta. The whole works is non-self. And one of the best suttas to actually to make that very clear is the teaching to Yamaka, the Yamaka Sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, where the Buddha says quite clearly, there is nothing there. That's actually Sariputta telling Yamaka that, you know, they, do you take the Buddha as this candle or that candle or all the candles together or outside of the candle, or what do you? He says, you can't even see a Buddha here. It's just a group of things coming together. The self exists or not, it's said very clearly again and again, no it doesn't. So you really are stretching credibility, sort of choosing some texts and ignoring others, and changing translations, because the hardest thing for a person to let go of, to abandon, is the idea of a self, of a permanent essence. It's as if, as I tell the monks, it's as if, and the nuns, it's as if that you work so hard, you abandon so much, give up so much to become enlightened. And after the death, the end of this life, do you mean I can't enjoy it afterwards? There is a tendency in the human condition to always want to have the ultimate retirement home after parinibbana. And so there's a lot of twisting and turning, contortion of views, as the Buddha called it. But it is so absolutely clear. Tomorrow, when we do the sutta class, when I can get that stick in that machine, and I can just quote those texts one after the other, it's almost impossible to actually to justify that view. And even says in there, there's also the wrong view. So even if a famous teacher says this, you should look in the texts and see what the Buddha said. Even if a group of teachers say it, compare it with the Sutta Vinaya, the text, and see what the Buddha says. And it becomes very clear. Clearer and clearer and clearer. You may not want to accept that. It may not be what you feel comfortable with. But as I said in that flower pot experiment, sometimes what we think can't be true, we just can't see. That is called the distortion of perception. So, there's no contradiction there. All that you see is just as the great bhikkhuni Vajira, Arahat bhikkhuni, all there is dukkha arising, dukkha passing away. Nothing more. Until the time of parinibbana, when that stops and it's gone. Gone forever. Poof. You're gone, baby. You're gone. Okay. Dear Ajahn, my mind is full of endless chatter. What can I do? Okay. You can have a lobotomy. Is it your... Nobody joking. Is it your mind full of endless chatter? Or is it your brain full of endless chatter? What's the difference between the brain and the mind? The brain, after a while, just dies. But your mind goes on to the next life until your mind has had enough. And lets go. Endless chatter. Why is it chattering? What are you running away from? This is what I was talking about today in the Sutta class on the five ways of overcoming those distracting thoughts. And the one I mentioned I like the best, the cause, why is it endless chatter? And number two, is it endless chatter? Is it all the time? Because, a little simile, this room, when you come inside this hall, what do you see? The people sitting down, you see the Buddha statue, the monks, the nuns, you see the walls, maybe if you look up, see the lights in the ceiling, But you ever notice there's more space in this room than there are people and things? There's more emptiness in this room. Now all the cushions and the boxes and the teddy bears, that only takes up maybe 5-10% of the space in this room. This is mostly empty. But we never notice emptiness. We notice the things. It's one of the reasons we really try hard not to put too many things on the shrine. Keep it empty. Because we're worshipping emptiness, not things. We're respecting absence, not stuff. You know, it'd be very easy to get more and more paraphernalia in this hall. More and more pictures on the walls. More and more chandeliers. More and more sofas. More and more, I don't know what more you need. More teddy bears is enough of them. Too many teddy bears. That's what happens. I go on retreat, and then we have a few teddy bears here. Then I just go to Bodhinyana Monastery, and when I come back, you find they've multiplied. I don't know what they're doing. They're supposed to be keeping precepts. So those two big ones over there, look at them. Just, I don't know what they're up to. But anyway, so they serve a purpose. But when you see there's spaces between things, and even in science, you know, when you look at the world, it's mostly nothing, this universe. It's, you know, it's just the amount of actually stuff there is like 99.9999999999999999% zero. However, God was number 10 to the minus 36. I don't know if I said enough zeros. It should be 36 zeros there. Mostly nothing. And then we find out that we never perceive nothing. We perceive what's there. Stuff which disturbs the nothing. It's the same way of silence. When your mind is silent, you don't notice that. You only notice the thoughts, the disturbances. Just like your computer screen. You only notice the things. When there's nothing happening, it just turns off. Goes into default. So, most of the time, there's nothing on your mobile phone. But you only notice it when there's a message. So actually, with thinking, with the inner chatter, it actually is not endless. It is not continuous. There are spaces between them. And that's also where it gets fascinating, with this idea of a permanent me. Your consciousness. It's not a stream of consciousness. It's a blip, 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 blip. There are times when the consciousness is just not there. It stops. But you don't notice that except through inference. Because when it's not there, of course, you're not consciousness, it's not there. There was this monk fourth year as a monk. And, you know, he was not a very inspiring monk, but every week he had to give the talk. And, you know, at night time to the monks, only about 4 or 5 hours of monks there. And when he would give the talk, he would fall asleep. He would just go unconscious. He'd be talking there, and then his head would drop. But then, 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes or 50, we never knew when, that was a problem. So he'd wake up again, and he would carry on the talk exactly where he left off. If he left off in the middle of a sentence, he would actually continue that sentence. So if he recorded it, the talk actually flowed perfectly. There was 5 or 6 minutes where he was unconscious and he never realized it. And he just stopped and then continued afterwards. And sometimes I wondered, was that me too? Did I do that? Because you would never know. Just like that simile of the blind spot. You're blind to the gaps between your conscious awareness. There are gaps there where consciousness is not present. There are gaps in the flow of thoughts and inner chatter where you are silent. So what we do as a practice, we try and perceive the gaps between things. When one thought finished and the other one has yet to arise. And what happens is you start to realize, I'm more silent than I ever thought. Because you only got used to noticing things. This room is more empty than full. And when you start noticing emptiness, space, it's far more attractive than stuff. And spaces between thoughts are far more holy, profound, spiritual, than actually words. So what happens is you start to appreciate silence and emptiness and spaces rather than things. Why is it that when a person conquers a mountain, conquers it, as if that you have to do a fight with a mountain and now you've won and you own it? That's really crazy. But what they do then, they put a flag on the top. And after a flag, a little while later, they put a restaurant on top there. And after a restaurant, a cable car going up there. And they can't they leave a mountain alone? Why do we have to put all these things? But nowadays they don't put flags on top of mountains. They put mobile phone towers. Why can't we leave things alone? And enjoy the emptiness, the space, rather than have things. And because we're afraid of emptiness, it challenges us. That's why the way we want to fill up the gaps in our life. Having a wall in your house, your apartment, whatever it is, you want to put something on the wall. Instead of just leaving it bare. You have a garden. Why do you want to put a flower in there or something? Why not leave it empty? You have a mind. Why not keep it free instead of cluttered? Apparently, I read it in one of the articles. There's a guru of decluttering, the decluttering guru. I think it's a Japanese girl, is that right? Yeah. But anyway, she never started that. That started by the Buddha. Decluttering your mind. Anyway, you got a question?
Actually, how do we perceive silence? Can we start by putting labels to it? For example, if I notice the gap, I say to myself, there's silence.
And then you've destroyed it. There were these four monks with a vow of silence. And one of the monks sneezed. Hay fever season. And the first monk said, bless you. Second monk said, you've just broken your vow of silence. Third monk said, so have you. And the fourth monk said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. As soon as you note it, it's not silent anymore.
So when I try to notice silence, I tend to drift off.
Yeah, well, do you? If you're drifting off, you're not silent anymore. So once you appreciate silence, you value it, you find that it's delightful, it's profound. There's something about silence in all spiritual traditions which people venerate. Here in Australia, there's so much land, so much space, and people actually congregate around the cities. I've never had that opportunity to go deep into the bush, the outback of Australia. They say you can go to a place and there's not another human being for maybe 100 miles all around. You're the only one there. And the silence just overwhelms you. Or even more than that, if you ever, people have been in outer space, so empty, so silent, it challenges some people. They may even go crazy. But if you appreciate silence and emptiness, it's the most amazing thing. But you don't talk about it, because then you destroy it. It's almost like desecrating the silence. It's also silence and emptiness, peace, is so great for the human health, physical and also emotional. Take a person out into the bush, into quiet places, and it's something, all their crazy thoughts, they can't be sustained for too long. The silence is too powerful. It dampens it down, soaks up all that crazy energy, and you become silent too. So don't give silence a name. Silence is shy. If you tell her name, she vanishes. Anyway, what helps you to be gender neutral, supporting nuns in Theravada tradition? How is it like to be different with other disciples of Ajahn Chah? You're not gender neutral, but you are aiming for that. There's still always work to be done, as Venerable Chanda often knows. So we try to do our best to give that equal respect and opportunity. Why do you do that? Quite frankly, not because of any philosophical tradition. It's because you met four women who were great samaneris who want to be bhikkhunis. Just simple, practical, not trying to change the world, but changing this moment. Quite frankly, I do not have a great world view to change things and do things. If I see something happening right now and I can do something about it, I'll do it right now. What are the consequences of that in the big future? I'm not sure. Because it could be done, and there were four women who really deserved ordination, great candidates, why not? And anyway, as always with other disciples of Ajahn Chah, I think a lot of the other disciples of Ajahn Chah are little by little coming around. If you hear some, you know, I've got my spies all over the world. And some of them are saying some, she was just saying this the other day in Thai, and I don't know if she got the name right, but you know, they were saying, oh, this, I think it was the most senior monk in Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Lien, was highly respected. And he was, she said, oh yeah, that was him. And she was saying, oh, she saw him recently, and she said, oh, you know, we miss Ajahn Brahm. And so, you know, we see Ajahn Sumedho, we see all these other monks, but it's been such a long time since I've seen Ajahn Brahm. He did nothing wrong. There are bhikkhunis around. There's always been bhikkhunis around. So it's interesting you say that. It'd be lovely if it was confirmed. But anyway, so that's it. Why are people more predisposed to positivity, negativity? Can a person with depression meditate? Of course they can meditate with depression. Because after a while, what is depression anyway? One of the reasons for depression, it depends actually how severe the depression is. Very deep depression, you know, the psychologists say you should have some medication just to balance something or other in your brain. I have to take medication to overcome my depression. I take vitamin C and vitamin T. You know what vitamin C is? Coffee? Tea? Vitamin T is a cup of tea. Nah, it works. You get a boost of energy. You're happy. Well, you know, usually happy anyway. But if you are just ordinarily depressed, one of the reasons is because you're tired. Of course you get grumpy when you and things go wrong in life. You're trying your very best and it's still not good enough, so you try harder and you get tired. And it's okay because, fed up, I've had enough. I'm going, no more. But no, that's not what happens. When you meditate, that's when you get the boost of energy. That is, that's much better than vitamin C or vitamin T, vitamin M. Meditation. Or actually vitamin S, samadhi, stillness. And I must admit, that's what keeps me going. Sometimes you just get so exhausted in my job. So I make sure I come up here and just get some meditation going before I give a talk. Then you get a boost of energy again. I remember, I tell this a few times, Eileen will remember this. Remember we did one of these, it was a show at the Victoria Theatre, I think it was. It was Open the Door of the Heart one, yeah. Yeah, or something like that. And anyway, so they wanted me to come along, because it was based on my book. And then the only time I could get there was arrive just in the afternoon, oh not the afternoon flight, just after lunch. And then it was straight to the matinee. And now, it was really keech, but it was okay. That just, what happened was that somebody had a lot of problems in their marriage or something. And then I think their father, found out they were adulterous and so got very upset. And then she said, and then I found this amazing book by this white monk, Western monk, Ajahn Brahm. And that was my cue to come on stage. Well, I was willing to do anything. So anyway, so did that. And then I had to give a little talk, just not scripted, just do it. And then afterwards, just had a long flight and had to get up early in the morning. The flight is a 6:35 flight, so I have to get to the airport by 4:35, which means I have to leave here about 3:35. So I have to get up about 3 o'clock. And that was, that's after the Friday night talk. So, I was really exhausted. And give everything you've got. And then I realised I was in trouble because I had nothing left. And you guys, you went off for dinner. So yeah, two shows. Yeah, the evening show. I thought, what can I do? And I found a quiet place. There was one of the exits which was blocked off, which was locked. And I could go right down the stairs to the bottom. It's locked exit. Great. Keep it locked. And that's my little cave. And I remember that. Had about an hour to get my energies back up. First of all, you start down here. Physically tired. But, I know not to fight sloth and torpor. You don't do battle with it. It's not Buddhist to fight wars. A war against sloth and torpor. I just sat there and just made peace with it. I was tired, not my fault. It's just been travelling, working hard, giving everything I got to that first performance. Encouraging other people. And then you feel very tired. So just aware of the tiredness, not fighting it. And then the energy started to go back into the knower. I wasn't doing anything. I learned that the hard way. Try and do things and fight things. You're wasting energy. I just allowed my mind to be still. Not pleasant being tired. But then the energy started coming back. I didn't straighten up my back, it straightened itself up. And after maybe half an hour, and then you start to see your energy's coming up, the smile comes up, the joy comes up, and nimitta's, And so in the afternoon, and the next show, you were just, just like you had a big shot of methamphetamines or something. I don't know. But it certainly was just a huge boost of energy so you could do your job. And sometimes that's how I survive in my work. You get caught on, you get tired, exhausted, and then you've got to look after people, give them some energy, and that's actually how you do it. So meditation, if you really get into it, it's a beautiful sort of resource. But if you don't get into it, you do get depressed. Why do I have to do this? I'm 60, I should be retired now. No, some years ago, it was actually only 1 year ago, I decided to apply for my Commonwealth Seniors card. You can get one, I think, when 60, even 60, well, 65, anyway, I'm 68 now. So I decided I'd get a Commonwealth Seniors card. Do I get any benefits? Nah. It's just because I've got one. That's all. No benefits at all. But anyway, I went there to get... So you go online, first of all. And you go online, not good enough, because there's such a thing as identity fraud. So I had to actually go up to the office, make an appointment, and bring as much ID as I possibly could. But a monk doesn't have much ID. So they came up there and they said, what have you got? I said, I've got a passport. They said, yeah, but we need something else. What? Your driving license. I'm a monk, you don't have driving licenses. Oh, now first of all, I've got to start the conversation where it really began. They said, we need you to prove you are who you are. And I said, I've been trying to do that for the last 45 years and I still haven't found out yet. And she didn't think that was funny. You know, sometimes people just don't get my jokes. So I said, okay, well, I said, ID. So passport, driving license, don't have one. Monks don't drive. This monk doesn't drive anyway. Okay, so your credit card. I haven't got a credit card. Your bank account, don't have a bank account. Your rental agreement, don't have a rental agreement. Your home ownership, don't own that. Your mortgage, don't own, have that. You know what they even asked me for? Your marriage license. They did ask me that. I was cracked up laughing. I thought it was very funny. I don't have a I'm not married. And what they said afterwards, they said, well, look, you've got no ID. You don't exist. Sadhu, the Buddha was right. I always thought the Buddha was right. But, you know, who are you? And you have all these documents to prove that you are who you are. When you don't have these documents, you're in big trouble. You don't exist. Sorry? Even birth certificate, got no photo on it. So anyway, I got around that because I got dual nationality. I've got sort of the British passport as well. I said, well, we're not really, but, you know, realise your problem and our problem. So they let me pass. That I really was who I was supposed to be. Mr. Five Candles. Always changing that. But anyway, it's interesting being a monk. Even at the airport once, going into Singapore, and they said, you've got to go through the customs and the security check. And the guy looked at me and he just said, like he says to everybody, have you got any hair gel in your bag? I looked at him. Hair gel, come off it. And he laughed, everybody in the queue laughed, and so we had a wonderful time. It made my day, that. Anyway, while they're predisposed to positivity and negativity, not predisposed, but sometimes you had a hard life. Difficulties in life. But after a while, negativity just doesn't really get you through anything. So you might as well be positive. You complain to everybody. No one listens anyway when you complain. So you might as well be positive. And you're positive. It's a much better attitude. And you get far more progress on the path. So you don't start thinking of all the things you haven't achieved. Think all the things you have achieved. You know, in the work which I do, just, I've already got mine. I've got my nice cave. I don't need any more. I've, you know, written a few books on meditation, so that's good enough. I've said enough jokes to last people, make people groan for the rest of their life. What more do I want to do? So, sometimes, I don't really worry about what's left undone. Still do stuff, help others. But, if ever I get also tired, I look for all the things we've achieved so far. The two bare bricks, which are still there in amongst toilets. Just no ordaining bhikkhunis, getting a big monastery, a few monasteries, teaching Dhamma, teaching a way of meditation which is full of joy and happiness, introducing teddy bear meditation, building this place so people could meditate comfortably. Now this was breaking the mold, doing things differently. Because a meditation center should be tough. Only for real yogis, ascetics. Allowing people to sit on chairs. That was breaking new ground. So all of this stuff, I look back and I was like, wow, it's great. How can you be depressed? Or negative? You're tired? Exhausted? But it was worth it. Not perfect. There's much more to be done, as always will be done. But it's good enough. So that's the sort of stuff which inspires. You know where I got that from? I'll waste the time the questions because I'll never answer them. I got that from, it was Ajahn Sumedho. When I first went to England, you know, he wanted me to stay there. To capture me while I was able to be captured and help over there. But he took me up to Scotland where they were having a retreat, only a few days, in this beautiful fishing town called Oban on the west coast. I forget exactly where they had this retreat centre, but it was idyllic. The west coast of Scotland in the summer is one of the most beautiful parts of the world. And so I was just being his attendant. And being his attendant, I would just be quiet there, just listening, getting bored. Heard that before. And then somebody came in, this woman came in, and then she said, I've just come in here to thank you for saving my life. And as soon as she said that, I really woke up. Maybe I've heard that before, but the way she said it was with such force. I think, what on earth has this American monk done? And then she told her story. That what had happened on that retreat, they actually made everybody take the 8 precepts for that retreat. And the fifth of those precepts is not taking alcohol or drugs. The fifth precept. But it wasn't explained clearly to her. And she thought that her prescription drugs were also banned. And she said that ever since she was a student at university, young woman, difficult times, and she got a little bit depressed, and the doctor there just prescribed her Valium. And she was taking it all her life, addicted. As she said, in that time, they were just giving Valium out like candies. Very simple thing. I'll take one of these without telling them exactly what they were taking. And she was addicted. Takes it every day. But when she went on this retreat, she didn't realize that it's prescription drugs. Please, you can take them. You don't have to give up taking your insulin and keep 8 precepts and die. So she stopped taking them for 6 or 7 days. And because it was a very peaceful environment and very kind, supportive people, and it was difficult for her, but after 6 or 7 days, you know, she hadn't taken one of her pills at all. And it was such a change for her to be like clear-minded that she thought, maybe I can carry on not taking this Valium. But the problem was, the retreat had ended, and she had to go home. And going home by public transport, the bus to Glasgow was okay, but she had to transfer from the bus to Glasgow railway station and get on a train there. And she said that she almost threw herself on the tracks. She almost lost it totally, because the stress, you know, someone who's so vulnerable and so fragile, was just almost unbearable. But she said she managed to hold it together to get back to her home. And she said she spent the next month, this is what she said in this interview, sitting on a chair, doing nothing, allowing the remnants of that drug to filter out of her system and get her own positive energy back. But all the time during that period, which no one should do, you know, she really was very lucky, but it was the Dhamma she learned. Things like this too will pass. Just, you know, be kind to the body. Don't try and force it. Have loving kindness towards yourself. Those things pulled her through. And so she said after that 1 week retreat and 4 weeks of sitting in the armchair, she said now she was free. And she said, you've given me my life back. I'm alert, I'm awake, I can enjoy, I can smell things, I can taste things. Thank you so much for saving my life. And when she said that, I was inspired. I thought, wow, that's really good. And so I made a resolution. What was my resolution? Was if only one person, just one person, in my whole life as a monk, says that to me, then my life as a monk would be worthwhile. Just one person. That's my determination, just one. You know what's happened? Hundreds have said that. But the first one said, right, that's it. Every other one is gravy, is extra. And that's inspiring. So that's one of the reasons, and it was like negativity. So you don't ask much as a monk. You don't want to save the world. Save one person. Help one person. And everything else is extra. So anyway, that was my resolution. So I've already done my bit. But nevertheless, you can always do a bit more. Anyway, but yeah, you can get out of depression. Oh my goodness, that's 4 questions answered. And it's like an hour. But I hope you don't mind if your question doesn't actually come up, and that it's just still important, interesting stuff. I really enjoy and I learn a lot from your sutta discussion today and the way you relate the first 2 qualities of Samawayama to the restraint of the senses and the dealing and distracting thoughts. However, I'm going to finish there. Next question. Even yet, I'd love to finish there, but I always think that if someone had the time and the energy and the care to write a question, then I should try my best to give an answer. However, to translate Wayama as restraint instead of effort is probably too far off. You can think that. The 4 qualities of Wayama is far more than restraint, but rather effort. Is it? In Majjhima 117, the Buddha says that the factors for Samma Samadhi is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. He doesn't say that. He said it's right view, it's Samma Wayama and Samma Sati. Because without effort, nothing is done. Without restraint, nothing is done. So, it's a translation. It's what's lost in translation is where the problem comes from. Whenever there's effort, there is a wanting, a craving. You want something. That's why you put effort for it. You go for something, and that takes effort. That is one of the problems. Effort encourages will. Will and effort are the same. And for much of our life, you think that will is your friend. If you want to get something, exert your will. Get off your bum and do something. But when that happens, people do so much in this world, they create so many problems. Instead of learning how to be at peace. I already mentioned Descartes. not Descartes, sorry, Louis Pascal. All the problems of mankind come from not knowing how to sit still. Amazing. Sometimes, often this happens. If you want to regenerate a piece of forest, put a fence around it and keep people out. It regenerates by itself. Leaving it alone, letting it be. Many times you've got a wound on your skin. Isolate it. Get any bugs out of it, but then leave it alone. And it heals by itself. Your body is made to heal itself, but sometimes we keep interfering with the healing process. Often, leaving things alone is the best way. But it's very difficult to do that, because we always want our will to get involved, to do something. The backseat driver. I don't know about if you've ever experienced backseat drivers, but there is one lady. She was here at the beginning of this retreat, by the way, so you know who it is. She picked me up from London Airport. It was her son was driving, and she was in the back seat. I was in the passenger seat. And my goodness, about an hour or two's drive, she didn't shut up. You're going too fast. Don't go this way. Go that way. Keep on the left side. Don't know. And that went for 2 hours. I've never seen anything like that before. Backseat driver. At least if it's on sort of those Google Earth or whatever, it's on TomTom, at least you can turn it off. It's very hard to turn your mother off. So, what was that other simile? I don't know when you're leaving here to go back and you get a taxi to go to the airport because, you know, you've got to get a special flight. Imagine you book the taxi. And the taxi driver comes here. And you put everything inside the taxi, you sit in the seat, and you say to the taxi driver, drive me to Perth Airport. And then you tell the taxi driver, he said, but you know, don't sound the horn, because I've just come out of a meditation retreat, it's a bit sort of harsh for me. And I'm a Buddhist, so be very careful, there's kangaroos on the road, so I don't want you to hit any kangaroos. And please also be careful, you go slowly, it's fine, but not too slow. And please let other cars come in, because, you know, I'm compassionate. I don't want to be someone who just has all these people honking at me because, you know, I cut into other people. So don't do it that way. Please turn your radio off, because, you know, I've just come from a retreat. I'm very peaceful. Don't talk too much. And you haven't even got to the front gate yet. And the fellow will say, get out. I know how to drive, I know how to get to the airport, don't be such a control freak. And that's what happens. We always get too much involved in what is none of our business. Which is another one of my mantras. Because one of the women here years ago, she told me, so I told my son to go and clean up his room. He told me, Nanya. I said, well, is that Pali or is that... I don't need to know what it meant. He said, have you done your homework? Nanya. He thought it may be some Aboriginal, indigenous word. And he said, you know, have you taken out the trash? He said, Nanya. And then she asked him, what does that mean? Oh, it's short for Nanya business. That was really disrespectful. But I thought, wow, what a good word. So, I'm meditating, and a thought comes up, is it time yet? And I say, Nanya. You got jhana yet? Nanya. So it's none of my mind's business. Have you arranged all the things for when you leave on Wednesday? And that thought comes up, say, Nanya, Nanya business. So I stop all my thoughts by telling them, Nanya. Isn't it wonderful? What time is it? Nanya. So in other words, what is your business when you're meditating? You think I should get enlightened? Tell your mind, none of your business. You're just being here, relaxing. People telling you what to do. You telling you what you should be doing. Nanya. You're doing what you are doing. You're being peaceful. Where are you trying to get to? Nowhere. You spent such a long time getting here. And now you want to get somewhere else? Can't you stop? Restrain, let go. This is where your effort stops. Here. Don't go anywhere. And if you learn how to sit still and not go anywhere, not want anything, then when you pass away, when you die, it's like a bus comes to take you to your next life, your next destination, a heaven or whatever. You're sitting so still, you're not moving, you don't get on the bus. In fact, because you're so still, you can't be seen. And the bus taking you to a next life departs without you. The end of rebirth. Anyway, so, the factors of samasamadhi is not just right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. The factors of samasamadhi are the whole Eightfold Path. The whole caboodle. I didn't actually find out what caboodle means, but it's a nice word. It is craving the desire that leads to the further existence, bhava, namely, karma dhanha, bhava dhanha, vibhava dhanha, or the mundane craving and desires for the pleasure of the five senses and delusions, such as sex, food, power, fantasy, etc. Even the what actually is that? Karma dhanha is the interest, the craving, the wanting, the entanglement with the world of the five senses. Karma loka is the world of the five senses. Rupa loka, now rupa loka, that's the world of the jhana realms and the arupa realms. And bhava dhanha is a wanting to be. You're afraid of not existing. You know that sometimes, I was brought up in the Christian tradition where the most scary thing would be if the devil came up and whispered in your ear, I've come to take over your soul. If that was me, I'd say, how much? Are you selling your soul to a devil? Yeah, I'll get money for my next project. And the devil will get nothing. There is no soul in here. He gets a bum deal. I got the cash for the next project. Do you understand that? I don't think you do you? Otherwise you'd be laughing. But this is our most personal possession. Who we think we are. When you get to that seat of the driverless bus, there's no one there. Emptiness. Then, it's challenging. But, that's the end. One of my friends was a Christian. And we had some great debates. I love just, talking with people who are different than me. Not always surrounding myself with people who think the same. So, before I was going to, I think, was it to Malaysia or somewhere? And we had this discussion, and then this Christian decided he just softened me up enough to convert me. And he said to me, he said, Ajahn Brahm, you have to admit that nothing is higher than God. And I looked at him and said, actually, I agree with you. Nothing is higher than God. And he looked at me. He knows I'm very sneaky and tricky. He said, yeah, nothing, emptiness, is far, anatta, is far superior than your God. And he said, that's not what I meant. Because sometimes, oh, I respect people, but when they're cheeky with me, I'll be cheeky back. I out-cheek people. But nothing, emptiness. So sometimes we have the one, the unity of all things, when things come all together. All united cosmic consciousness. Is that the highest? Of course not. Nothing is always higher than unity. Superior. That's where everything ends. Poof. You're gone. Anyway, craving, the desire that leads to further existence, power, leads to further existence. Kawa bhavadana, vibhavadana. Vibhavadana is thinking you can destroy yourself. Of course you can't. The best simile is from Oliver Twist, just like eating your own head. And as soon as they said eating your own head, I thought, now how can that be done? Of course it can't be done. You can't eat your own head. Just like you cannot kiss your elbow. Now you're already looking to see how you can do it. That's conceivable. You say, well, I don't know, maybe he can't, but I can. I do yoga. I'm not fat like Ajahn Brahm. But it cannot be done. But I bet some of you this evening, when you come back to your room, you go into your room and try it. Why can't you take it on trust from your teacher? Anyway, so that's actually why we get reborn. And this one was, I don't know. Okay, this is stress. This, there's one on doubt here. Somebody was putting this in, but I said just a small one on doubt. It's two pages. Doubt, hindrance of doubt. What is that? And the best way to describe that, because I mentioned the five hindrances. The best simile was one I obviously get from your own experience, because that's direct experience. What is doubt? Be very careful, because all these teachings, am I teaching the right teachings about non-self, or have I got it all wrong? How do you know? Can you really trust the teacher? Because these days teachers say so many different things. Is it the right teaching? Is this the right path? Should you be in Mahayana? Or should you be in Christianity? If you go to Christian retreats, you can have something to eat in the evening. So, and also, you can sing and dance. You can watch TVs. So, are you in the right place? But, people have doubts. It's good to have doubts. But, how do you solve doubts? So, there was a simile which I developed. I already mentioned how much I love the west coast of Scotland, the highlands of Scotland, the islands. I sort of love going there. That's, I'd take a tent, you know, the old fashioned tent, very heavy. And I'd take this little one little saucepan to cook things in. And I'd use, you know, this Scotch broth. It was dried peas and dried barley and some dried rice and dried oats and all dried stuff, and just, you know, find a sort of some water, there's plenty of water there, and just boil it all up. And it was very nutritious stuff. And so that was actually how I survived for days on end in the wilderness. But anyway, every now and again, you know, you just went to one of these youth hostels, you know, to, you know, replace your supplies and have a proper shower. And so I went to this youth hostel in a remote part of the northwest coast of Scotland. Any Scottish people here? Oh, okay, no. But anyway, it's a beautiful part of the world. And I went up there in the youth hostel, and there was only two of us there, because even though it was summertime, it was just too remote for many people. So anyway, that the youth hostel superintendent, warden or whatever you call, a local man who just looked after the hostel at summertime to get a bit of money, and he said, do you want to come for a walk up one of the mountains? Because it was a lovely, beautiful, clear, blue sky day. Yeah, sure. So I went up on the top of one of the mountains, sat down, enjoyed the view. And I saw there's another mountain not far away. And so let's go to the other mountain. He said, no, one mountain a day is enough for me. So I just was like my exercise and I just went up this other mountain. And I scolded him afterwards because he should never do that. In wilderness areas, you should never go alone. You always have someone with you in case something happens. And something really close to a disaster for me. Because as I was walking up to the second mountain, out of nowhere, the clouds came in from the Atlantic Ocean. Really fast. It was a beautiful sunny day 10 minutes before, now it was clouds. And those clouds descended over my mountain. I was enveloped in mist. And people have told stories to me. There was one particular Englishman who got lost on the moor for 3 days. And he almost died of hypothermia. Because when you are lost in the mountains, you have got no sense of direction at all. You go round and round and round in circles, trying to find your way out. And for me, I thought, nah, you know, I know my sense of direction. So once the mist came down, okay, just turn around and go back the way you came. And as I was walking, I was thinking I was just going back down again. I came to a ledge. It was the edge of a cliff. And there was only just one more step, and I'd be dead. If I was lucky, it was about a long way down on this cliff. If I was lucky, I'd be dead instantly. If I was unlucky, you'd be injured and just die slowly. Because it was remote, no one was there. No mobile phones. No one would be able to find out where you were. It was too remote. And so when I saw that there was a ledge there, I got really alarmed. It was mist, and so you could only see just, you know, maybe just the hand when it's extended. Further than that, you couldn't see at all. So lucky mindfulness, I just saw the ledge. Later on, when I looked at the maps, I was actually going almost 180 degrees in the opposite direction that I thought I was going in. So, I was scared, and so when you get scared, you have some fear, you just stop and reassess your situation. Illusion, delusion, was thinking I was going in the right direction, and I wasn't. How can I get out of that doubt, that mist of not knowing where you're going? And so, simple. When you put aside your fear for a while, you use this common sense logic. And my solution was, follow a little brook or a stream. Because it's always so wet, there's always little creeks and streams. Because I knew from theoretical physics that water always goes downhill. This is all new physics. In other words, if I followed the stream and made sure whichever way it went, I would follow it. If I saw it was going in the wrong direction or trying to cut the corner, no. I'm going to just follow that stream whichever way it meanders, because it's always taking me down, down, down. And so I wiggled this way, that way, all over, followed the stream. The stream became bigger as other little streams, brooks came into it, until it was big enough, I was following it down, and then got under the mist. Because that was my job, to actually get underneath the mist, so I can get my directions. Because the mist only is at the top of the mountains, down below it's okay. And I could see where the hostel was and do the long walk around the mountain to get back. That saved my life, but also gave me a wonderful simile. In life, you don't know which way you're going, especially in your spiritual life. So many different teachers will come up here and say, no, no, this is the only way. No, no, don't do that way, you're wasting your time. No, no, there is the self, there is not a self. Sometimes there's a self, sometimes there's not a self. It's both or neither. And you get very confused and doesn't really help at all. You say, no, no, I know. So instead, what you do is you follow the stream. What makes you more peaceful? More happy. Happiness is part of the path. More aware. More calm. So you can just be more peaceful in your life. And if you don't know, ask the people you live with. When you go back after this retreat, they will know whether this was going in the right direction. If when you go back, you're more a pain in the neck to your partner than you were when you came here, there's something wrong. But if you're more peaceful, more kind, all these positive qualities, you know, which you know must be associated with the spiritual goal, if they're increasing, follow that stream. If they're getting worse, go in the wrong direction. And you know that was the advice the Buddha gave to the first nun whose stepmother, Mahaprajapati. Whatever Dhamma you practice, you know, leads to renunciation, to turning away from the world, to peace, to freedom, to enlightenment. You know that that is a teaching of the Buddha. It's actually just what it does for you. That's how you know it's a teaching. That's how you know it's a Dhamma. So that's how you overcome doubt. Very simple teaching, but very beautiful teaching. It was a teaching the Buddha gave. It was like wet nurse, stepmother, whatever you call her. The first bhikkhuni, Mahaprajapati. Look what a beautiful teaching that is. So that's, if you come here, you go to another teacher, other teaching, and it really is making you more peaceful, more happy, not just, you know, for 5 minutes. Because that's, I also said this to someone today. They said, oh, but my sister has converted to being a Christian, she looks so happy. Long term, please. Because it was George Bernard Shaw who said the fact that new converts appear happier than non-believers is no more to the point than someone drunk appears happier than a sober person. Look at someone who's drunk on alcohol. Yeah, they appear happier, but it doesn't last. So, be careful. That's doubt. Okay. The rest of the question there, so I promise I don't need to talk about doubt. While we know the importance of preparing the body for relaxation prior to meditation, what happens when the pain in the legs through meditation just gets too much? Really makes it difficult to relax and achieve ease. Of course it does. So move the legs. Look, you know, my legs were a bit stiff, so I put them out. That's what I do. Stretch your legs. And in meditation, I was very happy to see that even some of the Thai teachers I used to hang out with, when they got a reputation as meditation teachers, and they too say during the meditation, you're meditating and your legs get a bit stiff or a bit painful, then move them. Of course it disturbs the meditation, but not as much as if you keep enduring the pain. That really disturbs it. In other words, it takes a minute or so to move the legs around and get another posture. Maybe less than a minute. Do it mindfully, slowly. You go backwards, if you like, in your meditation, but you soon make up that lost ground in a couple of minutes, and then you go much further and deeper. The meditation which we're teaching is called Anapanasati. It's not called Anapanasati. Not mindfulness along with pain. The Buddha taught the middle way to avoid those extremes. Atthagunamattanu yoga of pain. The pain just, and I know many people on this one place in Sydney, it's actually the same place as that executive who got it right, of the fellow who had a big cancer in his sinuses. This fellow who took me to this monastery where I had a meditation retreat, he just, you know, let it slip. He called the meditation hall, you know what he called it? The torture chamber. As if that, you know, without sort of all that pain, you're not going to get anywhere in your meditation. I said, what are you talking about? That's not how I learnt my meditation. That's not what Ajahn Chah taught. And I said, rename it. I said the entertainment centre, not the torture centre. Look at that. It's entertaining. Best entertainment in the world. The best joy and happiness you ever have in your meditation. Oh, yeah. So actually, I look forward to coming in this meditation hall. You know, it's every time I have a chance, get in here. Because I work too much and come in here, great, no work. Just sit in here and just enjoy. So this is the entertainment center. The palace of joy. The meditation hall. When I look at it that way, it changes the whole complexion of meditation. So that's how you can prepare it, by renaming this hall. Anyway, entertainment center, palace of joy, what else do you call it? You can make up your own name, but don't call it torture chamber. Vitakka vichara, directed thought and evaluation of thought. That's not what it means, but however, that's how it's translated here. Are two factors of the first jhana, and it requires effort and volitional attention to direct the mind. Exactly. That stops you getting into these jhanas. How can it be that no volitional effort is required as for what we discussed today? Vitakka vichara. You always translate these words in context. You translate sentences, not words. Vitakka vichara can mean thought in other contexts. But in the context of jhana, it's the last vestige of that thing which, if you let it develop, would become thought. Subverbal thought. The movement of the mind onto the object. Subverbal, not thought. Thought is gross. And you all know that. You feel that. Do you think these amazing jhanas, which are just so still, so powerful, which the Buddha said are, you know, superhuman states, do you think these have this gross thing called thought in them? These are amazing states. You don't, it's not thought. In the jhana, you're blissed out. Ecstasy is your object. Mental. Sixth sense, nothing else. So powerful. But in that first jhana, you still haven't let go 100%. Almost. And because it's the last vestige of holding the object, that causes it to move. That is the vichara, of holding it. And then what happens is, it's unstable. You like move away. But the bliss, the ecstasy is so attractive, it just pulls you straight in. That moving towards the object is the vitakka. In the commentaries, they call it ringing the bell and the resonance of the bell. That's not bad. Could improve it, but thinking, these meditations are far more refined than that. So, what happens next? The bliss, the ecstasy, the one peak of mind, where five things are missing, viviceva kamehi, separated from the five senses. You can't hear. You can't feel the body. Someone touches you, you won't know it. That is how deep this meditation is. And when you let go of a little bit more of holding on to the object, you don't move off it anymore. The holding on to the object is the vichara. But you don't move off it. There's no need for any vitakka anymore, no moving back onto the object. It's what Sariputta told him was that the in between the first and the second jhana. Vichara is there, it's just a slight bit of holding on, tiniest, last bit of holding, which means you don't need any vitakka. And of course, I always said that that really belongs to second jhana. But, you know, okay, vichara is there, but there's nothing moving. And then, when that last bit of holding just vanishes, because you are confident, sampasadana, you know, you don't need to do anything, there's 100% faith, you totally let go. without faith, confidence, trust, of course you can't let go. It's scary to let go and trust 100%, but that's what you do. One girl here, she was listening to me, and I always liked it when she came to the interview the next day. She said she had a dream about trust and letting go. And her dream was she was driving a car in the driving seat, sitting next to me, and losing control of the car, speeding, going towards a cliff. And as we went towards the cliff, you know, she could see it was a vertical drop for a long way down. And I told her, let go. Like, oh, we're going to die. Take your hand off the steering wheel and feet off the pedals. She said it was a scary thing to do, but she trusted me. It was in a dream. So she took her hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, and we hurtled over this cliff really fast. And she could see at the bottom of the cliff, there was a slight little bend, but what she was really scared of, that on that bend on the road, then there was a sudden sharp right turn. And as we were careering at just a speed which would kill anybody, she wanted to grab onto the wheel of the car and control the vehicle. I said, hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. And she did that. And as we hit the bottom, she wanted to put her hand on the steering wheel to make the turn. And I said, hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. And then the car by itself made this impossible sharp right turn. And then we were both going along the road, perfectly safe, no damage to the car, in safety. And that was her little dream. I said, great, now you do that in your meditation. To have that degree of letting go, because that's a good example of how scary it can be. But that trust means you totally let go. And in that passage from the first to second jhana, you're trusting and you're letting go so much that there's no more holding on to any object. You just stay there. When you don't try and hold it, it's still all by itself. And that becomes the amazing second jhana, which you can't miss, because nothing moves. It's not thought that stopped. Everything has stopped. Incredible stillness of the mind. Diamond-like samadhi. Absolutely no motion. And no possibility of motion. Because afterwards you notice something has disappeared. Something has, in the first jhana, what's disappeared is your body and the senses. In the second jhana, what's disappeared is this thing you called will. It's not there anymore. It's not like you don't exert the will. Most of the time, people have the will there. You can always push a button somewhere or do something. But now, that facility is nowhere to be seen. It stopped, it ceased. No will there. Which is weird. That's why it's so scary. Before, one sin is the most beautiful thing. There, can't do anything. Nice little story here before you go to bed. That there was a retreat in Sydney some years ago. It was a Vietnamese monk, Theravada monk, doing a retreat. Well, maybe I said too much already. But I think he's still alive. We try to keep these stories quiet if they're still alive. If they're dead, it doesn't matter. We tell. But anyway, this monk started the retreat, 9-day retreat. Friday evening, he had your briefing, you know, had some soup or whatever, and then first meditation. Half an hour meditation, then he was going to give a talk. So 7:30, everyone came into the meditation. 8 o'clock was supposed to be the first talk. It's only a few years ago it happened. And after half an hour went past, he was still meditating there. They were waiting for the talk. You know, just a little talk, you know, just to set the scene for the retreat. But he just, you know, 8:30 was still sitting there, hadn't opened his eyes. 9 o'clock, he hadn't opened his eyes. They weren't going to wait any longer. They all went to bed, left him there. Got up in the morning, he was still meditating there, hadn't moved. For 8 days, he just sat there. didn't eat, didn't drink, didn't go to the toilet, just sat there, didn't say anything, didn't move, totally still. And after the eighth day, then he started moving, came out of the meditation, and he asked for forgiveness. He said, "I'm sorry, I never gave you any talks or taught you the meditation, because I got into one of these deep meditation states, and once you're in, you can't come out." And then he said, "I'm sorry that I should have given you talks." And they all said, no, that was so inspiring to see this thing can actually be done these days. And he was right that he actually asked forgiveness, because it's known when you're a meditator and do these things, you make the resolution before you go into these states. I will go into these, if you know it's likely, I will enter that jhana for 3 hours or 6 hours or 3 days if you want. But then you set the time. And it's weird, but you will come out on the time you set. Within a minute. I don't know how that works. Mine's got its own little clock, I'm not sure. But then, the meditation, you don't know how long you've been in there, just enjoying yourself, timeless, blissed out. No effort at all. If there's effort, it will disturb everything. And then, you emerge. And then if you set the time, if you do look at the clock, yeah, dead on. Perfectly healthy. And another weird thing, if you've got aches and pains in the body, you'd be, you know, after maybe 1 or 2 hours you get very sore. If you enter the Mahdi, 6 hours, come out, no pain at all. Counterintuitive. You think, if I sat for longer periods, I'd be more sore. But no, with meditation something else happens. Your body gets so healthy when you deep meditation. So, that is vitakka vichara. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.